Welcome. This is Your Call. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This past October, the New York Times reported that income inequality in America was greater than at any time since the Great Depression. And aside from the obvious negative implications that carries for the Americans on the wrong side of the wealth divide, many economists also suggest that trend may be slowing economic growth and job creation. With the great majority of Americans facing stagnant wages and shrinking personal wealth, getting the economy going again is a lot harder. Louis Brandeis, Supreme Court Justice and advisor to Woodrow Wilson, also said that that divide may have implications for our politics. He said, "We must make our choice. We may have democracy, or we may have wealth concentrated in the hands of a few, but we can't have both." That's the quote that opens Who Stole the American Dream, the latest book by Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Hedrick Smith. And it gets at the heart of the story Smith tells about four decades of transformation in our economy and our democracy. Hedrick Smith is a former New York Times reporter as well as an Emmy Award-winning producer for PBS. He shared a Pulitzer for the Pentagon Papers series and won another for his international reporting from Russia in the early 70s. He's the author of 8 books, including The Russians and The Power Game, and now Who Stole the American Dream. Hedrick, it's so great to have you with us.
It's nice to be here, Matt.
And I just want to open the discussion to our listeners. Obviously, we'll hear some about what's in your book, some of your ideas, but I want to make sure that folks know we want them to join the conversation as well and to really ask the question, how would you answer the question that Hedrick Smith poses? Who or what is responsible for what he calls the dismantling of the American dream? And do you think that idea of the American dream still has power? If you're someone who came of age in the decades that Hedrick Smith is talking about, where it was unraveling, or if you're maybe entering the working world right now, does it resonate with you? If you came to the United States from another country, what did the American dream mean before you got here, and what does it mean to you now? The number to call is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So Hedrick Smith, you talk about Who Stole the American Dream. And in this book, you really cover 4 decades of change in the United States. But I want to go earlier, not just to that American dream kind of golden era of the 50s and 60s, but go and say, what do you think made that golden era possible? What was it that made that social contract you describe between business, major unions, and government possible?
Well, I'm glad you asked the question and framed it that way, Matt, because I think a lot of people assume, particularly young people, and by that I mean the people entering the workforce right now and maybe even people up through their mid-30s, tend to assume that life and the economy and politics were always the way they are now. What we inherited is sort of like the weather. It's God-given. There's nothing you can do about it. It probably never was really terribly different, unless you go into the ancient past, and then, of course, it was different. And I think people don't really recognize there was a time, young people particularly, but a lot of older people have forgotten it. There was a time when wealth was much more shared. Income in America was shared. Prosperity in America was shared. When the economy grew, for example, in the 30 years after World War II, and the workforce productivity in America rose just about 100%, 97%, the incomes of the average family rose 95%. So almost dollar for dollar. Mm-hmm. They moved along. So you asked a good question. What were the ingredients of that kind of performance and that kind of prosperity, or what I call the heyday of the middle class in America? And there are a couple of things that are really striking by contrast with today, and that's where it seems to me the lessons are important. One is that there was a very different attitude on the part of business leaders back then than there is today. Business leaders back then, I'm talking about Charlie Wilson, CEO of General Motors, Greg Jones, CEO of General Electric, Frank Abrams, CEO of Standard Oil in New Jersey, biggest corporations in America. Their idea in that long period was that they should support the interests of all the stakeholders in the corporation. Now, that word stakeholders is very important. Stakeholders in American democracy, stakeholders in the economy, stakeholders in the company. By that, they meant not just the shareholders, not just the owners, But the employees, the managers, the suppliers, the creditors, the customers have an interest in the survival. You buy a car, you buy a refrigerator, you want the company to survive so the guarantee, the warranty you have on it, and the spare parts that you need are still there. So you actually have a stake in the survival of that company. So that was their attitude. And they actually shared the wealth. They paid, if they paid an annual bonus, they paid it to everybody. Maybe the chiefs got the biggest bonus, but people down on the shop floor, people out in the sales force, they all got bonuses too. Very different from today, okay? So there was that attitude, and it generated what economists call the virtuous circle of growth. Pay your workers well. Even Henry Ford a century ago had this idea. Pay your workers a $5 a day, they can afford to buy the Ford cars that the company is producing. General Motors, General Electric, those other companies, IBM, so forth, pay the workers well, they'll go out, they'll spend their money. And actually, it is strong consumer demand that is the driving force of the American economy. The job creators are all of us. It isn't just the people at the top saving money and putting capital into businesses. We got plenty of capital at the moment. What we don't have in the American economy is consumer demand. We don't have good wages.
So I want to get to talking about how we got from there to here. And what, I mean, obviously, those contrasts, there's so many of them. You're going to draw them out, and you do it great, wonderful ways in the book. I guess my question is, I'm reading another book, preparing for a program we're doing on Thursday with a historian named Gar Alperovitz.
Yeah, sure.
And what he talks about is how the 50s and 60s in the United States, that those changes, that moment there, in a lot of ways was the result of the Great Depression and this war that transformed the economy, put the United States in a very particular position in the world. Why should someone now think we might return to that again, seeing as we're probably not going to go through those circumstances that brought that about?
Well, there are a couple of reasons, but we got to go a little bit further.
Go ahead.
One reason is that if you look at Germany, Germany is still there. And that means it could be done in the current conditions. We need to come back to that. Because everybody's saying it happened, it's nostalgia, forget it. I know Garporitz is writing, I've read a good bit of it, I haven't read the book you're talking about, but I know it's writing well. The other thing that was an ingredient was middle-class political power. Now, we're not exercising political power as a middle class today, but we had a strong labor movement, we had a strong women's movement, consumer movement, environmental movement. Yesterday was Earth Day. Yesterday was Earth Day. Earth Day 1970, 20 million Americans were out on the streets demonstrating in shopping malls, at college campuses, on radio talk shows like this. People were engaged, and they were demanding that the government do something about cleaning up the water and the air. Within a year, Congress had passed seven major pieces of legislation: Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, Safe Drinking Water Act, Anti-Toxic Substances Act. In other words, Congress responded to the people. Labor unions were very important in negotiating contracts, a social contract with General Motors, with General Electric, and so on and so forth. Steady income, rising income over
your
lifetime.
And unions also really critical to those other movements that you're talking about.
And their support was important. In other words, the middle class was exercising muscle in the political arena, in the economic arena. At the moment, the middle class is not exercising any political muscle much at all. I mean, there was Occupy Wall Street. There are demonstrations against the Keystone Pipeline. But when you compare the numbers and the degree of activism, so I don't buy the argument entirely of people like Alperovitz and others who suggest that it is simply an accident of history, and what's changed since then is market forces, technology, and globalization. If that were the case, we should see little Americas all around the advanced economies of the world. We have the most extreme inequality of incomes of any advanced economy. There's a thing called the Gini coefficient where economists measure inequality. The highest Gini coefficient of any other country is 0.33. Everybody's below that. We're at 0.47. We're practically 50% more unequal than any other advanced country. Even Citigroup, I'm not talking about liberal economists. I'm not talking about wacko journalists. I'm not talking about lefties. I'm not talking about the campus. Citigroup said in a fancy brochure to its high prestige, high wealth clients in 2005, the inequality in wealth in America, the concentration of wealth in America, was the greatest in any country since 16th century Spain. Now, that is a heck of a big statement. So we're not seeing it elsewhere. In Germany, it's striking. We've been told our companies can't pay higher wages because they couldn't compete if they did it. And everybody says 6 cents an hour in China and so on and so forth. Big deal in China is government subsidies attract our businesses. It's far more that than it is low wages. But in any case, German companies have increased their wages five times faster for their average workers than American companies? Well, you'd say, obviously, they're going bust, right? They can't possibly compete. Daimler, Benz, BMW, Siemens, Airbus, you name it. No. 2000 to 2010, we had a $6 trillion trade deficit with suppressed wages, and they had a $2 trillion trade surplus with high wages. Sorry. Something's wrong in the model we've been given by economists and other analysts. And then in addition to that, we've been told manufacturing is dead. It's over. We got to be a service economy. Banking, insurance, internet, Facebook, social media. We have 9% of our workforce in manufacturing. It's declined terribly, particularly in the last decade. Germany has 21% of its workforce in manufacturing, and it's exporting. That tells you something. Number one, those manufacturing jobs are not only great jobs for the middle class, they have a huge multiplier effect for the designers, the engineers, the salespeople, the marketers, the executives, and then in the towns where those companies exist, for the real estate agents, for the car dealerships, for the grocery stores. That is the core of a good modern economy, and we have let it go. It's possible to do it. Germany shows us it's possible to do it. So let's get off the old argument, and let's take a look at what the heck the difference is in their culture and our culture. That's what I'm telling you in Who Stole the American Dream.
This is Your Call. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. You're just hearing Hedrick Smith, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, talk about his new book, Who Stole the American Dream. The number to call if you'd like to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also post comments at yourcallradio.org. Hedrick, I want to find out from you. So you say Germany didn't leave this path. Describe, and you talk about 1970, you have Earth Day, you have a lot of other movements emerging, and you have a sense of real responsiveness. Richard Nixon, I mean, when you list off those environmental legislation that he signed in 1971, it is unbelievable. To us looking back now, to a lot of folks looking back now. And so what happened there in the 1970s that began that disconnect where the United States was on a different path than those other industrialized economies you're talking about?
Well, one thing is people stopped demonstrating. I mean, just imagine if today 20 million people went out in the streets and said, we want gun control. Just imagine what would happen. And let's say they went out in Arkansas and in Alaska and in North Dakota and in Montana, the states where the four Democratic senators defected from that bill, and people started demonstrating, saying they want gun control. What happened was partly we, the middle class, we, citizen activists, stopped being active. But there was a power shift. And one reason we stopped getting active was we were actually quite successful. The environmental movement sort of felt they succeeded. They got all that legislation passed. Now it's up to the government to do the job. Well, that's right to some degree, but it's wrong. The government only does the job if you keep popular pressure on the government to do the job. And instead of the people putting the pressure, instead of people power, we have lobbying power now. What happened was there was a power shift in the late 1970s. Big surprise to me. I was running the New York Times Washington Bureau in the late 1970s. I saw some of this happening, but I didn't realize what the causes were until I went back and did the research for this book. There was a guy named Lewis Powell who was put on the Supreme Court by Richard Nixon in 1972. But in 1971, Powell, who was a famous corporate attorney, well-known across the country, president of the American Bar Association, was deeply upset at what he saw was the danger to the American free enterprise system by the consumer movement, the women's movement, mm-hmm. the environmental movement, the labor movement, all these middle-class movements I've been talking about. And he said to business leaders, hey, you got to get organized. You got to fight back in the political arena. Because they've been doing economics. They've been doing business. They hadn't been playing politics. So he encouraged them, organize, stop fighting among yourselves, identify your enemies, go after them aggressively, take the high ground. And that is exactly what they did. In the late 70s, you saw a tremendous change taking place. It's amazing because we tend to think of it as happening under Reagan in the 80s. But it actually begins under Carter and the Democrat in the 70s. What I call Powell's army just mushroomed. Almost overnight, in 5, 6, 7, 8 years, short time period in American history. When Powell wrote his memo, there was no such thing called the Business Roundtable. That is one of the single most powerful voices, political voices of corporate America today. Business Roundtable, biggest 150, 160 corporations in America. They organized in response to Powell's memo. At the time Powell wrote his memo, there were only 175 companies that even had offices in Washington. 8 years later, before Reagan gets elected, before Reagan starts campaigning, there are 2,425. There are 9,000 registered corporate lobbyists. There are 130 corporate lobbyists for every single member of Congress. There are 50,000 people working for business trade associations. There's a veritable army there.
It's a huge mobilization.
It's a huge mobilization that takes place. And the reason is Powell's memo is secretly circulated among corporate leaders and business leaders by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. By the way, the Chamber of Commerce doubled its staff, tripled its budget. National Association of Manufacturers moved its headquarters to Washington. I mean, what Powell did was strike a nerve. Business leaders were already on the defensive. We had a revolt of the bosses, and they took the power back from the middle class. And we have been living with that. We're living with that today. We've been living with that change in the landscape of power in Washington for 30 or 40 years. And the policies we've gotten from government under both parties reflect that power shift.
Hedrick Smith, I want to bring our listeners into the conversation. We're talking to Hedrick Smith, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The New York Times in the past, also Emmy Award winner for his work at PBS and author of Who Stole the American Dream. I want to invite Dennis from Santa Cruz, who's called in to join the conversation. Welcome to your call, Dennis.
Thank you very much. This is really a corollary to a show you had about the financial crisis you had a while ago. Another fellow, I forgot his name, wrote an expose that dovetails with what you said. Everything you said is certainly true. I've lived this. What's next? Prescriptive solutions. The Occupy movement wasn't focused on legislative action. They were unfocused and diffuse, and we need to mobilize people in, I suppose, a old-fashioned way, old-fashioned being the 60s through 80s, to accomplish these goals. And the word social contract is so important. That's the one you used. Our culture has changed, and can our changed culture accept a social contract which will not have as many material goods to the average individual like Germany does? They don't have the material wealth we do. We've become inured to this, and a cultural change will be necessary for the social contract to be considered. Thanks very much. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Dennis.
Well, Dennis, your comments are right on target. There's no question about it. And as a matter of fact, I do go into the financial crisis in this book, particularly in the housing area, mortgage area, where the banks got involved. And by the way, where there was a transfer of $6 trillion of wealth from homeowners to banks during the period of the housing boom. So there are a lot of things that are misleading. Yeah, I think it's a mistake to call what happened in the 60s to the 80s is old-fashioned. It's actually been going on in Israel right now in the last several months. In fact, over the last year and a half, Israelis have been demonstrating, while we haven't been watching, Netanyahu has actually changed domestic economic policy under public pressure. So it's modern. We've got the Arab Spring. That's modern. It's only in our minds that it's old-fashioned. We need to retool our minds and actually get them up to date. People who think they're up to date think everything has to be on the Internet, everything has to be on the web, everything has to be on tweets. Those are useful tools. I mean, the Obama campaign has demonstrated twice that they can use the modern technologies, but they have a specific target. And what you said, and the target is getting the president elected, and what you said about Occupy was right on target. It didn't have specific targets. It wasn't just not having legislative goals. What we knew what they stood for. They stood for the 99% against the 1%. And they stood against the hyper-concentration of wealth. But what else did they stand for? Did they stand for cutting the banks down so they're not too big to jail and too big to fail? Did they stand for a financial tax on financial transactions on Wall Street that would fund programs that would help the middle class and help students pay for their college loans and not let the college loan interest rate go up, which it's going to do in June unless people get out and tell the Congress not to do it? Did they advocate limiting the salaries and the pay and the bonuses of the CEOs? Did they advocate a tax, say, on stock options, which is the main way in which corporate leaders get paid enormous, enormous, enormous paychecks? No, they didn't have specific goals. So one of the things we got to do is go back and get those kind of goals and be very explicit about it. Now, back to how do we do it? If you're looking at politics, I happen to think the gerrymandered political system is a disaster in this country. You've done something about it in California, but most states have not done anything about it. I happen to think that the Citizens United decision, which helped let loose a flood of big money into the politics, is bad. And there are a number of other things in the political system that are not good. It's a dysfunctional political system. There are several organizations working on this. Fair Elections is one of them. Common Cause is another one of them. Americans for Campaign Finance Reform is another one. No Labels is another one of them. There are a whole bunch of organizations out there already working on this, but they don't have mass popular support, and they need it. So people need to hook up with them. If economics is your stick, then there's an organization called the Campaign for America's Future. They're working on it. Van Jones is working on retaking the American dream. So there are organizations working there, but they require more than swapping emails. We have a whole generation
people to make a commitment.
Of people who sort of think, well, we can do it all by blogging or emailing. I'm sorry, that doesn't impress Congress. Congress is impressed by bodies, by people coming in. That's what the lobbyists are doing. They're going in there. They're actually writing the legislation and handing it to members of Congress. They're physically in their faces, and they're winning the game, and we're losing the game.
Let's hear from Kent in San Francisco, who's called in at 866-798-TALK. Kent, welcome to your call.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm curious if maternal custody, Title IX, selective service, affirmative action, the Violence Against Women Act factor into the research of your guest?
No, in all honesty, they don't. I'm really focused on what's happened to our economy, what's happened to the division of America into two Americas along lines of politics and along lines of economics. It doesn't mean that the issues you're not talking about aren't important to me, and I deal with them tangentially, but I don't deal with them directly. They're more
Kent,
social.
I'm wondering if you what you in bringing those up, what you wanted to get at.
Me?
Yeah, how you kind of see them fitting into this discussion?
Well, I don't know. They just adversely affected me in my life, and I think if it were the other way around, people would be up in arms, especially if it affected women the way it affects men. And the other thing that I was thinking about was if somebody can just come into the U.S. and buy a Social Security card to get a job, there's got to be a problem there, too.
Kent, thank you.
Well, those kinds of issues, particularly people coming in and illegal immigrants and not integrating them into the economy, puts a downward pressure on wages and on standards of living. I mean, there's no question about it. If you got those people legalized, you got them into the economy, they were paying taxes, they were also getting social benefits, their kids were, well integrated into the educational system, it would be contributing much more to the growth of the American economy, the strength of the American economy, and to the living standards of American people. Well, you get an even lower tier in the economic spectrum when you have a lot of people who are illegal because they can't organize, they can't protest, they can't fight for themselves because they don't dare do that or they'll risk being deported. So the more levels, the more echelons, the more castes we have, we almost become a caste society, by the way. We're no longer a land of opportunity. People tend to be more frozen in the belt that they were born into than was true in the past. America used to be the country in the world where you could move up most easily. It is no longer that. You can move up more easily in Scandinavia, Sweden, Norway, Finland, Denmark, Germany, France, Australia. There are plenty of studies out that show that. You can move up in those countries much more easily than you can here. So if you've got people who are disenfranchised and disempowered at the bottom of your economy, it weakens everybody.
That's Hedrick Smith. He is the author of Who Stole the American Dream? He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, and he's really focusing on where our economics and politics are now, how we transform them after this 40 years in which most people have seen wages and wealth stagnate or decline, while a few in this country have gotten much richer. That Gini coefficient that you talked about, Hedrick Smith, kind of startling when you see it compared to other parts of the world, and we want to have you join the conversation. The number to call is 866-798-8255. How would you diagnose the problem that Hedrick Smith identifies here? And does the idea of the American dream still have power for you if you are one of the younger people who maybe has come up in a time of different expectations than Hedrick Smith might have grown up with following World War II? Well, what do you think about the situation? Do you think the kind of political mobilization specifically focused on lawmakers in Washington makes sense? 866-798-8255 or feedback at yourcallradio.org. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. We welcome you to this conversation with Hedrick Smith. 866-798-8255. We'll be back after this.
KALW San Francisco. Your call to join the conversation, 866-798-TALK. Or if you'd like to, you prefer writing rather than to call, the email inbox is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Programming on KALW is supported in part by An Evening with David Sedaris. Sunday, May the 5th at San Francisco's War Memorial Opera House, David will be sharing an evening of all new readings and recollections in celebration of his newest title, Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls. David Sedaris, Sunday, May the 5th at the War Memorial Opera House. Tickets and information at davidsedarisontour.com.
Welcome back. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar on Your Call. Coming up in the next couple of days, tomorrow, Holly Kernan's going to be hosting a program about digital detox, people who are spending so much time on their digital devices, they have to go to camp to unplug for a weekend. So you want to tune in for that. Maybe you're one of those people. On Thursday, as I mentioned earlier, we're going to be talking with Gar Alperovitz. He's a historian who's looking at some similar issues to what Hedrick Smith, our guest today, is raising in his book, Who Stole the American Dream? We are talking today about the transformation of the American economy that's happened in the last 40 years, its connection to our politics, and how we turn things around. The number to call, 866-798-8255 or feedback@yourcallradio.org. Hedrick, if it's okay with you, I'd like to go back to our listeners. We've got a lot of great folks on the line. Great. Let's hear from Reza in San Francisco. Reza, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call. I think we are living in a dystopian world, which is a cross between 1984 and Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, where the masses are mentalities controlled by the media. And we've been essentially demobilized and being made to believe that we don't have power to change things. And I'll tell you where I think the imbalance of power is. The right is holistic in their approach. They have mobilized, as was said earlier, and they're attacking all aspects of politics and economy in a more holistic way. The left is factionalized. You've got the women's movement, you got the environmental movement. Each one of them has got one issue, but they can never seem to quite understand that they're all supposed to be on the same side and pulling with the same rhythm. And I think the real power is the media and the way that it controls the mind of the masses.
Well, you know, that's interesting, but if that were entirely the case, and certainly the media has fallen down on its job. I'm not going to beg off the media there. But if that were the case, you wouldn't have seen the Tea Party movement, which got born without the media. And I'm glad you reminded me about the organization of the right, because it's a response to the comment of an earlier questioner that the 60s to 80s street activism, politics is old-fashioned. The Tea Party is not old-fashioned. The Tea Party is very modern. What's interesting about the Tea Party is it came practically out of nowhere. It was a whole lot of people who were very angry during the 2008-9-10 worst period of the recession, but their anger was directed at the government instead of being directed at Wall Street. And so they took advantage of public anger, and they built a movement practically out of nothing. They demonstrated that it can be done today. It can be done without a heck of a lot of internet operation. They certainly got the backing of old-fashioned conservative, new right politicians and people with lots of money like the Koch brothers. And what they did was they actually exaggerated their power by effectively manipulating the media. Exactly, the opposite way around.
But as you point out in the book, I mean, it's a complicated story about how that emerged. But part of it was that some very wealthy right-wing benefactors decided, hey, this is something we want to invest in.
I'm only trying to suggest the media was actually captured by the Tea Party rather than the Tea Party being created by the media. So I just want to toss a little bit of a grain of salt into this analysis here.
Sure.
The media certainly plays a big role and has been taken over by corporations. But that's also a bit of a cop-out. We could be doing something on the center and on the left ourselves and not be manipulated, and the Tea Party demonstrates that. I don't happen to support the Tea Party. I don't agree with them. They only represent about 9% of the American public, but if you read the media, you think they represent 52%. That's not the media manipulating. That's the media being manipulated.
But I think it's fair to say when Occupy, when that I mean, I think in the same way, found a way to get into the media, which many people say, oh, you know, you're not going to be able to get a critique of Wall Street in the corporate-owned media, but they did.
No question.
But what there wasn't was, on the left and the center, those kind of, the equivalents of the Koch brothers on the left were not coming in and saying, how can we support this movement in the same way?
You couldn't be more right. If you go back and look at the effective movements in the 60s and the 70s, they not only had the shock troops on the ground willing to go out and demonstrate, but they organized and they networked out into the middle-class community, and they found wealthy supporters. And then they had legal supporters from lawyers who supported them. And yes, that was a whole full-fledged movement. Occupy never got to that point. Now, there are people who are working with Occupy demonstrators right now to retrain them, reorganize, and maybe come back. But there are other people working in other areas. I mean, I don't think it's beyond us. I don't want to take a defeatist attitude here. I think there's a little bit of a, we can't do it. Ernie Cortez, a friend of mine who's an organizer, a Saul Alinsky organizer in the Southwest in Texas and Southern California and so forth, says, you know, Rick, not only does power corrupt, and absolute power corrupt absolutely, but powerlessness also corrupts. It corrupts democracy at the core. If you believe you're powerless, you are in fact powerless. You help to make yourself powerless. We can't let that happen. We gotta put that down and go back to the sense of, yeah, it's our country, we the people. Last six words of my book, we the people must take action.
I want to read an email that came in from a listener named Denise, who says, could we find another term to describe people's aspirations than the American dream? The American dream is built on others' nightmares, starting with the theft of land from the original American populations. And I would add to that the question of whether the American dream and this kind of consumption economy that you talk about, the virtuous cycle, there were some pretty unvirtuous results of that, and Earth Day is one of the things that was measured that those negative implications for
sure.
The environment.
Well, part of the dream is the dream that middle class people, average people, can speak up. You said my book was focused on the economy. It is, but it's focused on the connection between the economy and politics.
Sure.
And so we're talking here. A dream is partly our ability to exercise our voice and have our influence on the political system that affects not just the economy, but the way the system operates. The women's movement said it's unfair for men to be making a dollar and women to be making 41 cents an hour for doing the same work. So it was focused on not just improving the economics, but improving the social justice within the economy. The environmental movement, as you point out, was not dealing with economic growth. It was dealing with the harmful effects of reckless economic growth. So I'm not suggesting here that the only gains to be made are gains that are economic. But one of the things you do find is when you've got a system that is not operating with much social justice economically, you're going to have all those other problems to boot.
I want to go to Emily in San Francisco. Emily, welcome to your call.
Hi. I just wanted to add to the conversation that usually when I listen to discussions about the economy, what is left out is the establishment of the Department of Homeland Security and also the legislation of the Patriot Act. The Patriot Act and the Department of Homeland Security is utilized to undermine any level of organizing at the very, even at the very local level. So I just wanted to add that.
Emily, great point.
That is a great point. And I think we got to go back and think about the willingness of the people who started the civil rights movement to be arrested to show the injustice of the Jim Crow system. If, in fact, there were a lot of people who went out and demonstrated on issues that are completely unrelated to any potential, even conceivable, in the wildest imagination, threat to national security, and they got arrested under some kind of Patriot Act or some kind of national security pretext, that would create another kind of protest in and of itself. I think we need to get to that. The issues you raised are of great concern to me. I was one of those guys who was wiretapped by Richard Nixon, J. Edgar Hoover, as a reporter for the New York Times. So I'm very sensitive to that issue. I did a documentary for PBS Frontline. It is available 24/7, Spying on the Home Front, and it deals with the tapping of the NSA of the internet and telephones right here in San Francisco. The case was right here in San Francisco, and I actually happened to have lunch yesterday with the Judge Vaughn Walker, who sat on that case. So those issues are tremendously important, and I think you're right. People are intimidated now by the apparatus of the and the philosophy of the national security state from daring to do what they want to do and think they should do in terms of social protest. But notice, there are people demonstrating over the Keystone Pipeline. There were people who occupied the state capitol building in Wisconsin in that fight with Scott Walker over essentially depriving collective bargaining rights to the public service workers in Wisconsin. There have been people in Occupy all across the country who've demonstrated. And we don't have much of a record of any of those people being jailed on national security grounds under the Patriot Act. So, I mean, I think I understand the fear. It's a legitimate fear, and I share the concern.
And certainly, even just knowing that those operations go on has a chilling effect.
Yeah, knowing that has a chilling effect. But it also, you know, you can't just say, I'm afraid there are other people who are out there doing it. I understand why you feel that way, but that's part of what we have to overcome. That's what Ernie Cortez is talking about, how powerlessness corrupts democracy at the core.
I want to go to Mitch in Oakland, who's called in at 866-798-TALK to converse with Hedrick Smith. Welcome.
Hi, Hedrick. Hi, Matt. Good to be on, and very interesting listening to the show. I found your ideas and suggestions very inspiring and kind of uplifting. You know, there is some hope. Obviously, there are a lot of problems. My comment has to do with a change in kind of the lack of large public works projects and the mobilization of low-wage workers to build beautiful things like what happened with the Civilian Conservation Corps and the WPA. And I'm just wondering if this has anything to do with the lack of a committed people who could manage those sorts of projects. Just from my own personal experience in the public, as a faculty member in the public university system, and seeing that the sort of the defunding and the flight of a lot of competent people from university system into industry, I'm wondering if the same thing maybe has happened in public works.
Well, it's an interesting question. At the end of my book, Unusual for a Reporter, I have a 10-point plan of 10 big things that could be done to improve the situation in America. I feel a little bit awkward about that because as a reporter, I don't normally advocate policies. Step number one is a massive public works program to rebuild America's infrastructure. I've been in China and I've traveled around the world doing my reporting for PBS on the documentaries I've made. The port of Shenzhen in China is now the third or fourth largest port in the world. Its output is greater than the ports of San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Long Beach combined. And one reason, it is a totally modernized port. It has the most modern technology. Our ports are way behind the Chinese ports. Our airports are getting out of date. Our highways, our bridges, our railroad system, their plans that have been put forward, by the way, backed, interestingly enough, by Republican ex-Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger of California, Democratic ex-Governor Ed Rendell of Pennsylvania, Kay Bailey Hutchinson, former Republican senator from Texas, John Kerry, former Democratic senator from Massachusetts, by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and by the AFL-CIO. So this is an across-the-board idea that you've just voiced. You can't get that done in the current Congress because the current Congress is driven by a small faction within the House, which is dominated by the Republicans, which is blocking any major spending on the investment in America's future. That is a political problem.
Now, there was an opinion piece in this Sunday's New York Times by two social scientists. I'm sorry, I don't remember their names. But what they'd done a study where they gave people information about economic inequality in the United States to see whether if people knew more, they would have different opinions about government taking action about this issue. And what they found out was that people's distrust in government and their sense that government can't really be a positive force made it so that even after they learn more and they said, yeah, that's a bad thing, they said, well, this isn't the way I would go about answering it. How does any kind of movement like the one you're suggesting is necessary overcome that?
Well, I think one of the things we have to do is to focus on political reforms. The political system is broken. It's dysfunctional. We can see that. We don't need any more information than we have already. One of the worst things going on is the gerrymandering. You guys have done something about this in the state of California, but nationwide, in the last House election, more people voted for Democratic candidates from the House than Republicans, okay? But the Republicans wound up with a 33-vote majority in the House. Now, what that means is the way we cast our ballots is not reflected in the outcome of the elections. And the main reason for that, not the only reason, but the main reason for that is gerrymandering. In the states of Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and North Carolina, more people voted for Democrats than Republicans. In North Carolina, there are 9 Republican representatives and 4 Democrats. In Pennsylvania, it's 13 Republicans and 5 Democrats. It's ridiculous. It bears no relationship to the outcome. Now, it isn't just the Republicans that do that. In Illinois, in Massachusetts, in Connecticut, it's the Democrats that do that. But we have an election system that does not reflect the public will. So when we look at the vote on the gun lobby and the gun issues, and we see that there's a disconnect between the country and Washington, one of the things we have to look at is the crazy political rules. The filibuster rule is now governing the Senate. In the House, the gerrymandering is now governing the way the House operates. If we had had a true reflection of the popular vote in the House of Representatives, you could have gotten to that issue that this gentleman was just talking about. You could have gotten, I don't know that people would have agreed on how much infrastructure should be, money should be spent on infrastructure. I don't know whether or not they would have agreed that that would have been item number one, but they would have at least tackled issues like that. We're stuck in a political system that is broken, and we've also destroyed the political middle. We have all these gerrymandered districts, which not only distort the election results, but which polarize the politics in this country. What each party is doing in the state it controls is to set up safe seats for its members wherever it can. And they even concede safe seats to the other party where it figures they can't win. In Detroit, in Michigan, the Republicans did the gerrymandering the last time around after the last census, as they did in many states. And the Republicans concede they can't win seats in Detroit. So they give Democrats safe seats in Detroit, but they take everything they can in the rest of the state. What happens is that people don't vote in those districts. Only the party faithful go out to vote because there's no point in voting in those districts. Nothing changes. So you get more and more extreme candidates on both sides. And they get elected, and then they go to Washington, and they can't even talk to each other. So what we need to do is to break down that gerrymandering, open up the primaries to all kinds of candidates, all kinds of voters, and give people in the middle of America, in the middle in terms of candidates, moderates and independents in terms of voters, get them more engaged, give them a stake back in the political system. So if I were starting reforms, I'd start right there. That's where people can get engaged. That's how you can get a movement going. And it can happen in every single community, every single state in the country.
This is Your Call. That's Hedrick Smith, author of Who Stole the American Dream. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. And I want to read an email, Hedrick, that came in from Carlton here in San Francisco. He says, well, let me see. I lost this. So you know what? Let's go talk to Andy in Santa Cruz. Andy, I know you've got something to say. Bring it on in. Andy, are you with us?
Hello, Matt.
Hi, welcome.
Matt, this is Andy from Redwood City.
Redwood City, welcome.
And hi to your guest.
Hi, Andy.
Mr. Hedrick. Hey, I wanted to bring up a point. I've been working within the Democratic Party quite a bit with various groups, DFA and PDA, and I find that people are afraid. They are scared to death to take on the Democratic politicians, and if they do something wrong, they vote the wrong way, they won't take them to task because they're afraid of the retribution that the Democrats put on these people. And the Tea Party was great because it was not afraid to run their ideology against established Republicans. In the Democratic Party, we can't seem to do that. We can't seem to get people that really represent us in the party in those positions because the party has such strong retribution against the people, and the people are afraid. They're cowed.
Well, I got to tell you, that's a terrible problem, and I don't know enough about your internal politics here to really comment about that. But you are at the heart of one of the problems here, that is people organizing. If people are organized, and I don't know how many there are in the groups that you've mentioned, but the more organized they are, the harder it is to deny them. And that's exactly how the Tea Party, you know, took the Senate seats away from established candidates in states like Delaware, in states like Arizona, in states like Utah, really conservative states. And there were fairly conservative people sitting in those seats, and they took it away. But they did it by getting organized. Matt is right. They also had the help of some very experienced people who saw this as a great opportunity, political operatives and strategists, and people like the Koch brothers with lots of money who were prepared to pour a lot of money into it. So those are the ingredients. But how you stage a revolt within your own party in your own locality is something you know more about than I do.
Let's hear from John, who is actually in Santa Cruz. John, welcome.
Hi. Just wanted to remind people, I think the political reforms you're talking about are absolutely crucial, and it is a measure of personal responsibility that's required to read all kinds of media. There's more information than anyone really needs out there. But the main thing is that I want to say is that the power we do have is an economic one, in the sense that we can decide what banks we put our money in, what funds we choose to invest in. Stockholders, shareholders, people that run companies are absolutely going to listen if people stop throwing money their way. And we had some success. Occupy was partially involved in getting banks to rescind different fee structures a year or two ago here in California. I know that in England, banks didn't used to have ATM charges at all. They've never had them, but they did propose them at one time, and the next day after Barclays and other banks proposed them, people were down there taking their money out of the bank, and they just put a stop to it. You don't have any of those kinds of fees there.
John, I'm going to cut you short just because we have a lot of folks talk to. I want to make sure Hedrick Smith gets to respond.
Yeah, sure. I think you're absolutely right. One example I would pick immediately, and it's in my book, compare the behavior of Walmart and Costco. Walmart has high turnover in its workforce. It uses part-time workers. It does not pay very good benefits. Not too long ago, we did a documentary for PBS called Is Walmart Good for America? That is also viewable online at PBS Frontline. And with pressure like that and from others, they instituted some better health care benefits, and then just last year they announced they couldn't afford them. By comparison, Jim Sinegal, the CEO of Costco, said, "We have a moral obligation to our employees and to the communities in which we operate to provide health benefits for our employees." They try to maintain steady employment. They pay better than Walmart does. And they try to attract customers who have a little bit more money and can afford and want better quality products. But the point is, their personnel policies directly affect both the way the economy operates and the way the social health structure is affected. And there's a choice you can make if you're thinking about shopping, if you're thinking about investing. And certainly, if you put money in local and regional banks as opposed to putting money in banks that are branches of Wall Street banks, you tend to give the regional banks more power and more economic power, and they tend to be closer to the local community. They tend to have different lending policies than the big banks do. They don't get involved in derivative trading. And so there are definitely economic decisions that people can make. You're absolutely right on. I agree with this guy.
And, John, I recommend you tune in on Thursday for our conversation with Garl Perovitz. He'll definitely be talking about some of those approaches. I do want to hear from Penny in El Cerrito. Penny, welcome to your call.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to comment on the concept that people are just too lazy or whatever to demonstrate. Millions of people demonstrated against the Iraq War. Millions of people demonstrated against the bank bailout. It was underreported. Nothing happened. If 20,000 Occupy Wall Street people come out and 10 Tea Partiers come out, the Tea Partiers get equal time. And it's because the media is a corporate right-wing media that absolutely backs the right wing, and nothing happens when the left wing comes out, so they quit. There's no question they quit. Why shouldn't they?
I'm sorry you feel that way. That's not the way I read the media.
I'm sorry.
That's not the way I read the media. I mean, I know about the events that you're talking about because I read about it in the media. I mean, I know about the demonstrators in Wall Street. I know about the demonstrators in Keystone Pipeline. I know about the demonstrators in Wisconsin. I know about people protesting against the Iraq War. I got all of that in the media.
Of course, but they'd say like, oh, you know, thousands of people demonstrated against the Iraq War when it would be millions. And then they say there was a strong Tea Party counter demonstration and it would be 10 people walking around with signs. I just feel as if people do try. People have come out, and now they no longer do it because people demonstrated against the Iraq War very strongly, and it happened anyway. People demonstrated against Bush being appointed. That happened anyway. People do not, you know, people aren't stupid. If nothing happens, they won't do anything.
Penny, well, thank you so much for
calling. I can just remind you that in the Civil Rights Movement, it took 10 years from the Montgomery bus boycott, excuse me, to the passage of the Civil Rights Act. So, you know, a lot of that is hanging there, and I understand your frustration. I'm sorry you feel the media is so unfair and so unbalanced. That's not my impression, but I'm in the media, so you can say I'm biased too, and it'll be easy to write me off. But I, as a matter of fact, I do have a serious question that millions of people demonstrated against the Iraq War, certainly in any demonstration that you could see that was anything like that size. The March on Washington, which I attended in August of 1963, there were 200,000 people. I was at the Lincoln Memorial. There were people as far as the eye could see.
I will say, Hedrick, just as someone who was in San Francisco when the Iraq War was about to begin, hundreds of thousands of people in the streets of San Francisco, for sure. So I just want to say, I know that we're a certain place in the body politic, but just to kind of defend what the position Penny's taken.
Yeah,
there, so.
Fine.
But, I mean, not to say that I think that your point about what gets into the media and whether it's as biased as folks may perceive from here, I think that's something to argue and something to discuss.
Yeah.
And I think what you raise even more importantly is the fact that just because it's not getting covered doesn't mean it can't gain power and over time. And
And I also think that Washington is the place where the decisions about the war are made. And if you want to demonstrate, I mean, I have to tell you, all through the housing crisis, I sat in Washington waiting for tents to go up on the Mall from the millions of people and their friends and families who were wrongfully forced out of their houses, and I never saw a single tent go up. Now, that is a major issue that affected millions of families across the country. It was a central issue in terms of the collapse of the economy, and there was an argument about bailing out the banks and bailing out the homeowners, and there was no movement that was visible on that at all. And it was to my great disappointment. It was to my great shock. I mean, I can remember even a few years ago when farmers were bringing their tractors and parking them on the Mall in Washington. If you want to affect policy in Washington, you got to go to Washington. I mean, I think what you did in San Francisco is great. By the way, we did slowly get out of the Iraq War, and public opposition to it was part of that. President Obama got elected as a foe to the Iraq War.
Hedrick Smith, so many people wanted to take part in this conversation. I want to thank you so much for this new book, Who Stole the American Dream? Really important reading and a really valuable conversation. Thanks so much for being with us on your call today.
Well, it was great to be here, and I hope people find it useful in actually regaining and reclaiming the American dream.
Thanks to everyone who called, emailed, and took part in the conversation. I'm Matt Martin. Be back in just a moment. Are you in need of digital detox? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about digital overload. There are people now who get so many emails and texts every day that they actually sign up for a camp that requires them to leave their devices behind for days. So where do we draw the line between the convenience of hyperconnectivity and its costs? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. As our presence becomes more and more defined by being online, how do we make it socially acceptable for people to unplug? It's Your Call with Holly Kernan and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.